Session number 17585, Reel 3.
Major Pringle, Reel 3. You were just talking about the allegiance of the populations around about
the
British
Troubadour. Yes. So, although I had made contact with members of the Czech resistance, I hadn't realized, and we didn't realize, that in actual fact, it was not as we were not as well placed as we thought we were, and it's understandable why the Germans did put out that order in July that anyone attempting to escape would be shot, because they were genuinely afraid of uprisings. See, for instance, at a place called Lambsdorff near Breslau, there were 30,000 British other ranks. Well, 30,000 people, even if they're not well armed, can do a lot of damage. But of course, there are not many people who would have wanted to be involved in anything like that, because we knew very well that if we attacked, or we could call it attacking the Germans, we were outside the Geneva Convention, and there was therefore no reason why we shouldn't be shot or dealt with in any way that the enemy wanted.
Could I just interrupt the narrative
to ask you
more about David Sterling? And was he exactly the same as you in his attitude towards the war and escape?
Or were there
differences between you?
No. We were 100% at one in what we wanted to do. He was more... He had to get the agreement of the senior British officers in the camps that we were in to be able to do the things we did, because there was a certain element among the British that didn't want these escapes to be planned or to be carried out, because it would mean that a lot of punishment came down on people who were not involved. But David managed to... He had a very commanding personality, and he was a tremendous leader. And so where these things took place, which, as I say, are quite described in quite detail, both in Czechoslovakia and later in Kolditz, he was the person who was really the leader in these big attempts. And I was usually the person who provided the liaison skills with Czechs, whoever they were, because of my languages and because I was really... I was his second in command, but really dealt with things which he couldn't deal with himself. I could talk to Germans. I could deal with certain things that he wouldn't have been able to deal with himself, but which I could. So I was really the man on the ground, and he was the one doing the what I might call the planning with me, and the organizing of getting everyone in any prison that we were in behind him when we were involved in this kind of thing. There's a big contingent of British officers which we could understand very well, for instance, married men and so forth, who didn't really see why they shouldn't just sit the war out and leave all these things alone. We understood that very well. Unfortunately, we weren't married. We didn't care what happened to us, really. But a lot of people did. And we were very sympathetic to that attitude, although we tried our best to get them to help us in other ways.
When did the Germans finally lose patience with you and send you to Kolditz?
From Marisch Trubau, when they discovered that I'd been in touch with the resistance. In actual fact, they then condemned David and me to death in our absence in the Dresden. The Germans could do that. They'd try you in your absence. They'd appoint a lawyer. You never knew this was happening. They were always very anxious to be correct. And so when we were sent from Mary's Trubau to Colditz, we were simply summoned one day to the senior British officer, who said, "I've had information from the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, the German authorities, that you were tried in Dresden, both of you, for, I forget how they worded it anyway, sabotage or treachery or whatever. That they called us Deutschfeindliche, which means that enemies of Germany. We didn't see why we shouldn't be enemies of Germany. Anyway, the senior British German commandant said, you've been sentenced to death, and it will not be carried out for the time being. It depends on what happens from now on. So in other words, we'd had a reprieve, but they had this death sentence so they could do it legally whenever they chose. As I say, the Germans are always keen on being very correct and doing everything by the book. But this way they could do it. They'd shot the airmen just out of hand with no preparation, nothing. They just decided they were going to shoot them. But in our case, they wanted to make sure that they could say, well, we did everything correctly, we tried them. They had their own lawyers. Of course, we didn't know anything about this, as we'd never been anywhere in front of any magistrate. But they could then say that they'd done all that was required. But it didn't make us feel very happy to have this death sentence over our heads, I have to admit.
Preyed on your mind as a sort of Damocles.
Well, it did. We tried to disregard it, but it was there all the time.
So were you then sent as a consequence to Colditz?
Yes, this was when we went to Colditz. In August 44.
What were your first impressions of the place?
Well, we met a lot of old friends there who'd been escaped over the last 4 or 5 years in Germany. It was, I very recently had been back there for a television program to do with Douglas Bader, who we shared a room with there. And I have to admit that it's a fairly forbidding place, but not as forbidding as Garvey in Italy. Garvey was a much tougher nut. Colditz had a lot of architecture. It had all sorts of things that you could manipulate to deceive the guards. Garvey had nothing. It had just rock. Anyway.
Who shared this room that you were in?
Douglas Bader, David Sterling, myself, and a fourth Tsar called Peter Dollar. We shared a room. We had a very good morale in that room. The War Museum has the television of our return there.
Had you known Douglas Bader before this?
No. But we were natural allies, because he was the same sort of person as David and me. He is a person of great morale and very amusing, a very nice man.
Did you then set to work trying to escape from Colditz?
No, we didn't. Nobody tried to escape after they'd given the order that we'd be shot after capture. But we did get in contact with the German resistance. Hardly ever people didn't know that it existed. And again, it's in my book in great detail, and I won't go into it here. But as the war was coming to its end, let's say when we turned 1945, we were able, through guards, which I was able to suborn, talking to them and threatening them and so forth, to get in touch, to find out whether there were people in Kolditz town who were anti-Nazi. And we discovered that there were. We made contact with them through devious ways, mainly through one guard who completely came over to us. And we set up in Kolditz town we found out that there were quite a few anti-Nazis in Kolditz, and we organized them to do as much damage as they could during the last days of the war to whatever they could do locally to impede the German. You see, the Russians were very close to us by that time on one side, and Patton was very close to us on the other. So the Germans were not all that certain that they were going to win the war anymore. And we took advantage of this to get them to do a lot of things that they wouldn't have dreamt of doing two years before. And I think it was perhaps the only prison of war camp where direct liaison was made with local Germans. I don't suppose that there were many Germans 2 years before that would have dared collaborate with us. But, as I say, with the Russians on the Vistula and Patton nearly into Czechoslovakia, some of them were inclined to think a bit about this, and we handed many carrots to them, which we actually honored later on, especially to certain of the officers in the camp who we managed to get onto our side, who would have gone to Russia for 5 years after the war if we hadn't been on their side when they were tried later on.
In other words, you gave them chits of recommendation.
That's right. That's right. But
how had you originally got into contact with anti-Nazi Germans in Kolditz?
There was a Czech officer, very good-looking, very attractive personality, who was sent to Prague to the dentist. And, that's later, who had to go to the dentist in Kolditz, in the town of Kolditz. And the receptionist there was a German girl who absolutely fell for him. He was very good-looking, extremely attractive man. And this girl fell for him. And he was sent to Prague for what reason. And she met every train coming from Prague for 3 or 4 days until he came back, when she managed to talk to him and say that she'd do anything for him that he wanted, and that if he could get in contact with her and ask her whatever he wanted, she would try to do. Well, of course, David and I knew this Czech, and we knew now that we had someone we could use to get information that we needed. And then we also found a guard who was a young chap, only about 17 or even less. And we discovered that his father was the leader of the anti-Nazi people in the village. And we got this boy, we lined him up to be a courier between us and the girl. So we had a direct line. He came on guard every night or every day, and we were always able to see him. And so we made plans, which are too detailed to go into now, about things which she then organized in the village. So with the boy and her, we had a way of you might say, asserting our intentions and will from the castle into the local village. And it worked very well. We managed to spot all the important things in the village because it was quite close to the front and a lot was happening. We could see from the castle. We found where the fuel supplies were, we got the telephone operator in the commandant tour to tell us and to listen in on any telephone calls from the Gestapo to the commandant. She relayed whatever was said to us. And one way and another, we were pretty close to what was going on in the village because we were afraid that they might take us as hostages and we wanted to know what was going on. And we found out pretty well through this network that we managed to set up. It was not only the guard and the girl. They managed to make many other contacts, which we were able to use. So that when the Americans eventually came, we practically had an organization ready in the village to run it and to help the Americans in many ways, which saved them having to go through what we'd gone through for several months. It turned out to be useful to them.
But what did you do with this intelligence that you gathered?
Well, we were really out to protect ourselves. We were in considerable danger of being shot as hostages. There were 11 people in the camp, Churchill's cousin, the Queen's nephew, and people like that, Alexander's nephew, who were virtually hostages anyway in Koldis. They were in special quarters and so forth. And we'd been told that they were the ones that were first on the list, but everyone was on the list. And we needed to know what was going on. That's really what we wanted, which we did through this telephone operator. And we thought we might have to take some very serious steps if they were going to take us away, because, as you know, they were going to set up a citadel, really, in the Austrian Alps. We knew all about this. We knew about this, really, from the Germans. And when they took 11 of us away in the middle of the night, there's no reason why others of us shouldn't be taken the next night and the next night and the next night. So really, it was very important to know what they were doing and what they were thinking, and this allowed us to. We pretty well knew everything that was going on.
Seems a bit surprising that they should have placed you and Sterling in the same room as
Absolutely, Barter. Absolutely. Why they didn't separate, David and I had been involved in, we haven't gone into all the things we did, but they more or less knew about it, and they still didn't separate us. We would have been much less effective separated, because he couldn't have done many of the things that I could do, and I couldn't have done some of the things that he did. So it was a stupid thing for them to do, and I never could understand why they hadn't separated us very early on.
But at Koldis, did they say you four will be together in this room, or did you just have a choice?
No, they allocated. No, the senior British officer, we were put in through the gates. They searched you, opened the gates, and threw you in. And the senior British officer said, "You're going here or there." We were field officers, so we would always be with other majors or colonels. And I suppose there was room in this room, so he said, "You go in there." It was quite fortuitous. Quite fortuitous.
Did Bader ever tell you anything about his career?
We knew all about him, yes. I mean, well, we knew what everyone knew, that he had lost his... See, his legs were off here and here, so he really was in a bad way. And up until Bader's career, nobody with that sort of disability had any idea that they could do anything. They were just going to have to sit in a wheelchair and do what they were told. And Douglas it was who broke down that fear of trying to do anything. Douglas, in the end, had a handicap of 8 at golf. He did anything he wanted. He flew planes, played golf, and this was a tremendous contribution to what's happened to all disabled people since then. Being, of course, he was immensely egotistical, really. But anyone who's had to do what he did isn't likely to be a mouse. And he certainly wasn't. And in some ways, he was quite selfish. But he changed the whole world of disabled people. He was a remarkable chap. Quite a funny thing. When I was doing this television thing for the BBC, they were looking up anyone who still lived who'd known Douglas. And one of them was his second wife, who I didn't know. I knew his first wife. And they asked her, "What was he really like?" And she said, "Well, he was an absolutely charming man, perfectly sweet, but a real bastard." And if they'd asked me that, and if I dared to be so, that's exactly what I would have said. That's exactly what he was. He was a marvelous chap, but could be a real bastard.
Seems something of a paradox to say the two things.
Yeah. Well, a person with such a unique background, and the things that he did were so unusual, that he couldn't be like other people. It wouldn't have been normal, really, for him to be.
What happened then when liberation came at Colditz?
Well, Eisenhower had... it was known where we were. And Eisenhower was told that he must make sure that his guns didn't level on us, because it would have been a natural place for them to think would be a German strong point. And so although fighting was going on all around us, when I say all around us, within 15 miles of us, no guns were ranged on Colditz. And this fighting was going on all around us. And then, I suppose, in the first days of April, we were hit by a shell, but this was a tank, not a gun, a gun on a tank, who hadn't been told. You see, the artillery were told not to range on us, but tanks weren't told that, because they were supposed to be on the move and they wouldn't be. But when this happened, we knew that we were things were going to happen around us, and they did. We saw the Germans retreating through the village down below, and then one afternoon, or was it a morning, tanks appeared in the woods just below, about 4 miles away. And we knew that something was going to happen pretty soon. And we went to bed that night. When we woke up the next morning, two lone GIs were walking up the hill to the camp. And they had a wireless set with them. And they said, the Germans have withdrawn completely from here, and we're going to bring a tank regiment into. And do you know any reason why the Germans could, when they say that they're withdrawing, is there any way that they might lure us in for an ambush? And we didn't think there was. And we told us, so he wired. He went on the wireless to this regiment, which was in the woods. We couldn't see. And by noon, we were free. And they took over the village, and we had to stay for nearly 5 days because fighting was going on all around, and they couldn't get us out. So we stayed there, but we weren't at all worried because we were happy. The Germans weren't there. And about 5 days later, they took us all out to Leipzig in lorries, and the next day we were back in London.
Why did you not stay in the army after the war?
Well, quite wrongly, I thought that having missed out 3.5 years of the war, it would be a big disadvantage to me as a regular officer. I was wrong. Quite a few prisoners became generals if they stuck around, and it would have. But I was never sorry I did, because I had a more interesting life doing the things I did after the war than if I had been a soldier. Although I did like soldiering, but it looked as if we missed out the most important part of the war. We'd be badly handicapped, but we weren't.